Jupiter-like. And it turns out it was.
Or is.
Okay, so the title talks about a new or the newest Mach number. So this is an analogy to the original Mach number. So I'm going to be talking about a bunch of different kinds of Mach numbers. They're all the same, but they depend on what kind of wave you're talking about. So the original Mach number was a sound wave, and that's, I'll start with that. But I want to think about it in terms of a portfolio of Mach numbers, and we can order the different kinds of waves that affect an atmosphere, an ocean, or a plasma tokamak in terms of their speed and in terms of their size. And so let me order them that way. And the three kinds of waves that are most important for oceans and atmospheres are sound waves, buoyancy waves, and vorticity waves. Now, sound waves are sound waves or acoustic waves. Everyone calls them that. Buoyancy waves are sometimes called gravity waves. In a physics department, you usually get a snicker for that, because it's not the Einstein gravity waves, it's not gravitational waves, of which we are now observing every one or two a year right now, it seems like. This is just throwing a rock into a pond. These are just buoyancy as in gravity, as in just, you know, just water going up and down in your bathtub. So it's nothing big about that. But they're very important in the atmosphere. If you've ever noticed little ripples, little sort of zipper-like ripples, we see them all the time here in Louisville in the clouds. Those are gravity waves up in the atmosphere. And then vorticity waves, you'll also hear those called Rossby waves. That's a meteorologist from the 1940s from MIT. He did a lot of work in meteorology. A lot of things are named after him. They're also called planetary waves. And these are the biggest, but also the slowest waves. And so those are the three. It'll turn out that these guys are by far the ones that are most important for today's discussion for about the stability of jets. And when I say jet stability, I'm talking about something as simple as a meandering jet stream, like if we talk about the, you know, we haven't really had a very cold winter yet, but if we do, it's usually to talk about a polar vortex. So if the jet, you think of the polar jet coming down like this, so day one, day two, day three, that's a wave, actually. It's called a Rossby wave or a vorticity wave. It's very slow, very big, ponderous wave. And so those are going to be the ones that control the stability of these jets, whether it be in the plasma tokamak or whether it be in the ocean, anywhere. Okay, so sound waves. This is a beautiful little shot here. You can actually see sound waves if you're clever. This is called a Schlieren system, and it's basically a shadowgram. You have a very, very fast camera and a very bright light, and you can see the shadows that the sound waves make. And there's a full-scale model of this, or a full-scale laboratory for this at Penn State. And this is one of their poster child pictures of them. This is a gentleman wearing ear protection and shooting a 44 Magnum. And you can see all of these are shock waves. So when you think of sound waves, you think of really fast, moving faster than the speed of sound, you think of shock. So that's kind of the theme for today. And you can see the shock wave, the oldest shock wave, the original, the first one that happened when he fired this weapon, is going to be the largest one. So notice this very big bubble. Now that's not a circle, that's actually a sphere. He's inside this sphere. That's why he's wearing his protective headgear. That is coming from where? Look at where it started. It's the actual explosion of the bullet in the back end of the gun, and you can see the smoke coming out still from the gun right there. And when, you know, you've seen, if you haven't shot your own Magnum, I think I did it in Boy Scouts once or something like that, but you've seen it. It's very fast, and you don't have anything except a single report is a, and then the bullet goes out like this. There's a bullet right there. Okay, so the largest shockwave he's got is coming off the back end, and you can see there's another one coming off the front end here, and then there's the bullet, the beautiful little shockwave there. And you can actually see there's two shockwaves, just like the space shuttle. Remember the good old space shuttle? There's a shockwave off the front of the bullet, and the shockwave coming off the back of the bullet. Basically, the rule is anytime you go from supersonic, cross down through a Mach number 1 to subsonic, anytime you make that transition in that direction, from supersonic to subsonic, it's required you have to go through a shock. It's absolutely, you can't go through that transition. Now, you can go subsonic to supersonic without a shock, there won't be a shock. But if you go supersonic to subsonic, okay, so let me just give away the whole talk. We discovered that for vorticity waves, so the third type of wave I'm going to get to, that no one had ever really talked about the shock of vorticity waves in shear, jet stream shear. And it turns out the shock of that particular kind of wave is instability, is shear instability. And a supersonic, in quotes, is stable. And as soon as you cross to subsonic, across the analog of the Mach number that we're going to talk about, that's actually shear instability. Now that, we've been looking for that for over 200 years. So I think we found it. And we found it from physics, not math. So that's kind of my big theme here, is that we shouldn't rely on just math and math theorems. Okay, so that's sound waves. I could spend a lot of that. It's such a cool picture. Okay, and this is another cool picture. This is buoyancy waves, just waves on a lake or waves. This is a case of Severn Boar, a seasonal boar that comes down in England and people know when it's going to happen and they surf on it. This is not quite cresting here, but you can see some white water. So one of the themes you can see from this is that there's a fastest wave. Then there's sort of a dispersive wave. And these buoyancy waves or gravity waves are very dispersive, unlike sound waves. Their speed depends on their wavelength. And so you have a fastest wave, and then you have these ripples behind here like that. Now, it turns out, even ducks are supersonic. this is, and you are too if you swim at any speed at all. You know, if you've been in a boat and you come into the harbor and it has a little sign that says no wake zone, that you kind of do, but you have to go pretty slow to make, not make a wake. You're dropping down to subsonic, what you're doing. Subsonic in quotes, not relative to sound waves, but relative to these buoyancy waves. And any duck will swim faster than the speed of these buoyancy waves. And notice that the pattern he's making is exactly the same as off the front end of that bullet. That is a sonic cone that any of us would make, even just dragging your finger through the water fast enough. Now, if you drag your finger through water very slowly and you're very careful and look at it, you actually have these little waves right in front of your finger and no wake behind it. Does anyone notice those little waves? There's a little sort of wrinkle, almost like you're pushing a tablecloth.
No wave.
Say again?
No wave.
It's not actually. It's not a gravity-induced wave. It's actually surface tension. It's a capillary wave. And it's caused by the surface tension of the top of the water, and you can actually now, you'll want to do that next time you take a bath or just brushing your teeth. If you have some water, just drag your finger through it very slowly without, not fast enough to make a wake, and you'll see little wrinkles in front of your finger. So there's those little waves. These waves I'm talking about here are actually just the supersonic, in quotes, waves. Okay, and then we have the vorticity waves, which are the largest but also the slowest. And the most famous example of one of these rocky waves or vorticity waves is the hexagon on Saturn. But you can see if you look carefully at all these different jet streams, there are waves everywhere, all over the place on the planet. And they're actually, those are the visible ones that are sort of sploshing in latitude. But you also have them sploshing this way, which is harder to see. You have to look in the temperature field. They can splash vertically. So in other words, the thickness of the atmosphere can go up and down. Those are really fast. So those are all versions of vorticity waves. Those are the ones that we're going to need a new Mach number 4, or an analog to the Mach number 4. Okay, so I told you, I kind of gave away the punchline, which is that we think now that the shock of these vorticity waves and jet is actually shear instability or jet instability. This is a ribbon. This is at 47, right in here. It's about 47 degrees north latitude. It's a second jet stream on Jupiter, I'm sorry, on Saturn that meanders. So there's this one that meanders in a like almost too perfect hexagon. But then there's this ribbon. This is a side view of it here. And you can see it's actually puckered up here and it's actually breaking. It actually will turn into a vortex and break. It's very unstable, and yet right to the north and to the south of it are these incredibly straight, half-straight jet streams, which is typical for Jupiter and Saturn. So how in the world do you sandwich an unstable meandering jet in between these straight ones? Well, the answers to these are now rolling out pretty quickly as we think of these in terms of this analog of a Mach number. So let's get to what a Mach number really is here. Okay, the first thing we need to know is that there are a lot of non-dimensional numbers in fluid mechanics. Some of you may have studied that or know about that. There's a lot of R's. There's Richardson number, Reynolds number, Rayleigh number. Then there's Crannell number. There's a lot of lofty numbers. I would argue, bias perhaps, that of all these important non-dimensional numbers that describe the science and engineering, that the portfolio of Mach numbers are maybe the first among equals. I would say that they are the bookkeepers for information propagation. And I'm talking about like event horizons. I mean, this is an astrophysics crowd. You guys like things like black holes. That event horizon is just as interesting and dynamic as in your sink. When you brush your teeth, you see that little ring. The water comes down, makes that little ring. That's a shock. That's a shock for these buoyancy waves. It's an event horizon. It's every bit as dramatic as the black hole event horizon. And so what keeps track of that information, which is being carried by the waves, is how fast it's moving upstream relative to a flow that's sort of opposing it, trying to push it away from you, right? That's where these event horizons and these shocks come from. The reason you have a shock is because there's no warning. You have to add that. There's a lot that goes into that. But basically, if you can push the waves away from you faster than they can come up, then you are supersonic flow. But however, if your flow is slow, like in the air in this room is slow enough that the waves coming out of my mouth are coming to you easily, than the waves are going upstream easily. So it's this idea of information trying to propagate against the current. Okay, so let's do let's ground this idea in terms of the sound waves, the Mach number. We just use these days the first two letters of the person's name that's named after it, so MA. And if you can see, this is a ratio of a speed. Now we use the letter U, it's velocity, it's like a flow velocity. We didn't use V. It's U, V, and W because usually it's, you know, east, north, and up. And so just generically we use the U. So that's going to be my flow speed, like the jet stream speed, like literally, you know, 50 miles an hour jet stream. Then there's a denominator, and that's in this case CS. The S stands for sound, so that's the speed of sound waves. Why is there a minus sign? You don't usually see that when you open up a textbook about the Mach number. It's because sound waves are omnidirectional. I mean, someone sitting over here could hear me talk. They go all over the place. They go in all directions. And so you always just take the upstream one and you always have it. It's not a problem. So you don't really even ever even write this minus sign. But the concept upstream is that minus sign. And you know, if the stream is going this way and the wave is going that way, if you actually do it in terms of signs plus and minus, you need that minus sign so that your Mach number is positive when the waves are going upstream. We need that. Now that's going to be important for vorticity waves, as you'll see in just a second. Okay, so that's what that looks like. Now I'm just going to ask you guys for order of magnitude, if you know. The best way I think to think about sound waves is in terms of like thunderstorms. Like you see a flash, you know, the speed of light is so much faster that it's essentially instantaneous for this argument. You see a flash and then you count seconds, right? Has everybody been taught to do that? And you count so many seconds and then you hear the thunder. And you know it's very rumbly because it's been very dispersive. So you got, what's your rule of thumb? How many seconds per mile? You're saying three? Three? Somebody say five? Who said five? Yeah, so it's 340 meters per second. It comes out to be 4.7 seconds. So it's 4.7. So it rounds up to five. So it's about 5 seconds per mile. So if you hear, if you see lightning, and then you start counting, and then it gets to the thunder, it's about, and you count to five, it's about a mile. Usually if you count more than about 3 miles, you start to not hear it very much. It's pretty much dissipated. But it's about 5 seconds per mile, it's 4.7. That's the speed of sound at the surface. So the speed of sound is not a constant, it goes, it's proportional to the square root of temperature, but that's a weak proportionality. So it's about 5 seconds per mile. Okay, so now let's go to larger but slower waves. We'll go to these medium waves, the buoyancy waves. They have a Mach number. It's not called the Mach number, it's called the Froude number. So my razors at home are called Mach 3, not Froude 3. So Mach somehow got to it first, but these are called, the Froude number is exactly the same. It's exactly the same, except that the denominator is the different kind of wave. So you have the flow speed, you have your minus sign because you want to measure the upstream wave, and you have, now instead of an S for sound, you have a B for buoyancy. So this is a buoyancy wave speed. And so buoyancy waves are all over the place. They're in the bathtub, they're in the duct is generating them, they're all over the place. They're also in the atmosphere internally. Not just at an interface, like a water-air interface. They're all over the place. Anytime you have a stratified gravity field and a stratified fluid. So in our atmosphere, when you look up and see them, they are so slow. They are 10-minute periods. Now, I could stand here. What time is it? It's 7:18. I could stand here until 7:28 and do one for you. And at, you know, 5 minutes from now, it's 7:23, I'd be down to here. And then another 5 minutes, I'd be back up to here. They're excruciating. You'd have to be a Zen Buddhist monk or something to be able to watch these things. The only time you really can see them is like in car commercials where they've parked the Jeep Wrangler on the cliff and they've sped up the clouds. Anytime you see our clouds going by and you speed it up, you can see they're actually bouncing. So there's a lot of these internal waves. In fact, if you get the right kind, they look just like you're at the beach underwater watching the waves go over you, but that's up in the sky, up above your head. So it's about a 10-minute period. If you take the 2 pi, which is, you know, the full cycle in 10 minutes, then divide by the appropriate length scale, which is the vertical scale height of the atmosphere, which is about 8 kilometers or 5 miles, then you get 10 minutes over 5 miles. That would be 2 minutes. And then the 2 pi is like a 6. And so it comes out 2 minutes when that 10 is divided by 5. It's 120 seconds. So 120 over 6. About 20 seconds per mile. So you can see that the buoyancy waves in a typical atmospheric situation are slower, but not by a whole lot, about a factor of 4 or so, than the sound waves are. Okay, and now let's get to the waves that are the sort of the main point of the talk, which are the vorticity waves. And this is the newest member, newest Mach number of the portfolio. All through the 19th century, it was quite clear, starting in the 1800s with all those people whose names start with R and Calvin and other people, about how important the Mach number is to all of compressible flow, including all of aerodynamics, as you know. And then buoyancy waves are incredibly important to what we call hydraulic flow, hydraulics. And yet, vorticity waves should have the analog of the Mach number, but you won't find it. Maybe a couple of papers in very obscure, but you won't find it associated with this kind of talk. So it's like the prodigal Mach number, it's missing. So it's really odd. It's the same thing as the others, it's minus the flow speed divided by, now instead of CS or CP, V for buoyancy, it's CV for vorticity, so it's the speed of the vorticity waves. And there's one wrinkle, this doesn't explain why we don't have this Mach number in the literature, it doesn't have a name. I'm gonna call it the Mach number in quotes, and I'm not gonna be sitting here doing quotes all night long. So from now on, when I say Mach number, it's gonna be this analog. So we need to know that. I'll show you that. That's like 2 pages of math, and then I'm gonna pay for it with that funny movements of the people on the escalator. The vorticity waves are unidirectional, not omni. In other words, they only go in one direction at a time. Which direction is that? They go where it's high vorticity. Turns out it's the vorticity conservation that gives them their life, that gives them their restoring force. They travel such that high vorticity is on their right and the low vorticity is on their left. So if you have a gradient in vorticity in your environment, then they go along that. Okay? So if the vorticity, normally it would go low in the south and high in the north, and so these waves would go westward. But it's perfectly allowed to have it the other way so that the vorticity is lower in the north, and then the waves would go eastward, and they can even go any direction. Just have to have the high vorticity on the right. So I've been talking about upscale and upstream waves and making my Mach numbers all positive and my Froude numbers are all positive. If my wave only goes in one direction at a time, I do not have that luxury. It could quite possibly be, and quite easily, about half the time is the case that the wave is only going downstream, in which case it's a negative Mach number. So the one wrinkle with this new guy in the block is that it can actually be negative. So Mach number can be negative. And that's why I want to show you some escalator, funny escalator movies, because negative Mach number is pretty funny. It's not as funny as supersonic, but it's pretty funny. We'll get to that in a minute. So to earn that, I know that mixing minus signs in beer is not such a good thing, but to do that, first let me show you how the Mach number is actually, we need the most general version of it. So this is the analog for the vorticity waves that's basically going to explain why and when jet streams are unstable, which has all kinds of applications. Okay, so that same thing that we've been seeing. So I need to show you what the numerator and denominator really are here. The numerator is the flow speed. We tend to write that in terms of a thing called a stream function, and it's this Greek letter psi, it's like a pitchfork, and you take the derivative with respect to north, this is latitude, and it needs a minus sign. There's a lot of minus signs in this little page here, so we're just going to keep track of them all. Okay, so I'm going to just replace the numerator with the stream function version of it. So I just replaced the U with that. I saw these two minus signs. So even if you're drinking a lot of beer, and you guys aren't drinking too much beer, and I'm pretty sober at the moment, you know that you can cancel those two out. So let's go ahead and get rid of those two minus signs. Now let's work on the denominator here for a minute. And you'll just have to believe me, I'm not going to derive this for you, but the speed of these vorticity waves is another minus sign, and then it's a length called a deformation length squared. Actually, Rossby, as in Rossby wave, gets credit for this. It's called a Rossby deformation length. And then it's proportional to that gradient I was talking about. High vorticity on the right, low on the left. So you have to have a gradient in the vorticity in order to have these waves. So that's the simple formula for the speed of these vorticity waves. These are the ripples that you see. The things that we aren't getting this winter for some reason. We're not getting that polar vortex crashing down on us. Unless it's just hanging over in China all winter long. It's just crazy winter that we're having right now. But you guys have been around here, right? A couple of years ago. Whoa. Yeah, polar vortex was amazing. So we do get these guys, and you've seen the Weather Channel with the, you know, day one, day two, to the big undulation. Okay, so that Q there is called potential vorticity. That's the official vorticity. It's actually got three kinds. It's got just a regular vorticity. That's simply the spin of an atmosphere. It's just the turning. And it's got a planetary vorticity, which comes from the planet itself, and that's a Coriolis effect. And then there's a stretching vorticity. It's really simple to understand that. So if you've got a column of air that's spinning, and you pull it this way, it has to pull in this way because it conserves its mass. But you know what a skater has, what happens to anybody, a skater, anyone that's spinning slowly, if they pull in their arms, they spin faster. So this vorticity, or the rate at which things spin, is affected by stretching this way, and that turns out to be a big deal. So there's three kinds of vorticity: just the regular spin, then the planetary part, which depends on latitude because of how we project our local vertical, so that no effect at the equator and a full strength effect at the pole and a full negative strength at the south pole. So there's a planetary vorticity, there's a relative vorticity, and then there's a stretching vorticity. There's three. Those are all incorporated in this value Q here. So that's the formula for that. So we put that in the denominator, and I just took the minus L d squared, put it right there. And you see, this first semester calculus where you have this kind of ratio where you have a derivative with respect to something like y and another derivative, that's a chain rule. So that actually cleans up. And there it is. So this is the general formula for the analog of the Mach number for these vorticity waves that we're going to need. And you can see that there's been a lot of minus signs, but we still have one here at the end. Okay. The Mach number that we're talking about for these jet streams can be negative. When is it negative? Well, it's just mathematically. It's whenever the correlation between the stream function and the vorticity is positive, and then it's negative. But I'm not going to leave you with that. I'm going to show you in a minute. After the second page of math, we'll show you the really funny. It's worth it. Hold on. I mean, if you have a full bladder, you might want to go to the bathroom because these are really funny movies. I guess you have to have a slightly sadistic sense of humor because people are not making it up out there. Okay, let me sneak a little sketch here in the side here. We're talking about stability, so I have to do this. This is like a child sitting on a swing. It's not moving. It's just pensive or bored or looking at her phone or whatever they do these days. And so you have a position which is like an equilibrium point, and there's no velocity. Now, if you were to plot this little dot right here, if you were to plot position and velocity for that child, there would just be a dot there. That's the equilibrium point. Now, it's a stable equilibrium because if you were to pull the child and give them a little push, they'd start to swing, and so both their velocity and their position would start to move. If you plot that and you have some friction, what happens is the second picture here, you get a nice little spiral in this phase space, and it spirals in very slowly, depending on how much friction there is, until it finally just settles back down again. That's this thing in phase space, something like that. Now, I told you at the beginning, we don't have any friction or any viscosity. These are huge jet streams. The friction and viscosity effects are 6 or 7 orders of magnitude down. They're completely negligible. So what we have are inviscid stability questions. And in that case, it's this third picture here. So if you have an equilibrium, like a jet stream that are happily going past each other, and you perturb that by some means, then it's stable if it walks around in the phase state and now is a circle. Instead of spiraling in, it's actually making a little orbit. Okay? And if you have a very stable, what we call a nonlinear stable system, you just have a lot of these orbits. Now, back in 1880, when Rayleigh very famously came up with the very first math proof that sort of set off all this stuff, Kelvin, who wasn't Kelvin back then, he was William Thompson, there's a creek that runs through his backyard called the Kelvin River. And he was the first person to be given a lordship for science, and you have to come up with a name. So he said, it'd be like Jerry here being called Lord Ohio River. You know, they should be named himself after the. It's not a good creek either. Anyway, in 1880, at that same sort of magic year, he realized, you know, this looks like a topo map, like a Boy Scout or Girl Scout topo map. It looks like just a topography or topo map, but those are ambiguous, aren't they? Is that the topo map of a hill or a valley? Could be either. That was his insight from 1880. And then it took 85 years for someone, and this was a Russian named Arnold, to come up with what the actual topography is. And today we call it the pseudo-energy. But I'll just show you it in terms of pictures here. This is now called the Kelvin-Arnold first stability branch, and it's literally just the stability case for no friction where you have a valley. Okay, and so these little circles and that little white dot are supposed to be the same ones here. It turns out, if anybody remembers in the calculus here, if you're at the bottom, if you're at a minimum, then the second derivative is positive. Do you remember that a little bit? That's what this positive is coming from here. So there's our friend the stream function, there's our friend the potential vorticity. And basically, if they're correlated in a positive way, then you have this negative or minimum energy. It's called the pseudo-energy. Okay, let me go back one here. This is the history of this thing, and that's really where I don't care too much about the math. I want you to see the history. I'm not a pope. I mean, popes talk in terms of centuries. They're funny that way. I'm talking in terms of centuries. I'm feeling a little funny about it myself. Look at where this started. In Rayleigh, 1880, then Cool, 19. Look how slow we've been at making progress. These are all stability theorems that are special cases of this branch. And so all of these stability theorems are encapsulated in that very simple statement there. Pyotov, Charney Stern, Repo, these are all basically just adding bells and whistles to the thing. But they're all included in this one. And they're all what you find in the textbooks, both science textbooks and engineering textbooks, of which I've got 20 in my office. You'll find these in all of those. There is a second branch, and not a single student is taught this. I was not taught this. I had to discover it by doing Jupyter analysis. There's a second branch. It's almost like there's a secret club. There's a smart people like Glenn Clearle at MIT came up to me and said, oh, by the way, literally whispering, your flow is stable, because I thought it was violently unstable. I was violating all these. Every single one of those is being violated by a factor of two like Jupyter. He said, no, there's a second. Okay, I want to get started. But I guess my generation and the younger generation needs to rewrite the textbook or something, but it's ridiculous. It's not mentioned in standard textbooks. And there's two textbooks that have it, very obscure ones, and they're very disparaging about it. It's just ridiculous. So anyway, it looks like this. And remember I said if you're at the bottom, then your second derivative, your second variation is going to be positive. Well, if you're at the top, it's going to be negative. But here's why the mathematicians kind of avoid this. It's not just compared to zero. It's compared to this length, this deformation length squared, like that. So it's a little bit more finicky to do the proofs for this one. But it turns out this is by far and away the more important of the two. Okay, so the main thing, and I'm almost done with all this math, the main thing with fluid mechanics is you're supposed to non-dimensionalize. You're not supposed to walk around talking about meters and, you know, hectares per fortnight. You're not supposed to be talking about that stuff. You're supposed to be talking about numbers and non-dimensional numbers. And we have been going since 1880, Rayleigh, I can blame Rayleigh, with all these fancy proofs about all these stability theorems, all of these guys, they're very fancy proofs mathematically. Not one of them was non-dimensionalized, not a single one. And that's just ridiculous. Okay, it was neglected through the entire 20th century. Not once will you see it non-dimensionalized. And one of the reasons is the math proofs. They don't require non-dimensionalization. So let's non-dimensionalize. There's our Mach number, so we're just going to multiply by minus 1 over L to D squared. See it? Now, do remember your simple math. If you multiply an inequality by a minus sign, you have to turn it. Okay, so what happens is you get the Mach number, less than 0. There's that negative Mach number that's going to be the escalator. People falling down the escalator. We'll see that in just a second. Next slide. Okay, this is, I don't want to get too excited here, because, you know, obviously I'm getting emotional about this. This is an industry-wide embarrassment. To have all of the textbooks from the 1880s onwards, every single one, I'm talking about every single textbook, and everything is taught to all the scientists, we're talking about tens of thousands of people, and they are all studying without knowing it the Mach number, and it's negative. It's not even a regular sonic Mach, it's not even positive. It's an industry-wide embarrassment. Okay, now the other one is the same way. You multiply by 1 over L to D squared, and you get supersonic, just like an aeronautical engineer would recognize it. Mach number bigger than 1, supersonic. Well, it turns out both of these are supersonic. They're supersonic in different ways. And finally, you guys have been good, we finally get to talk about, by the way, the two of them can be put together. You just take the reciprocal and cover both of these cases. Finally, okay, for me this is my favorite slide, escalator analysis. You say GIF or GIF? G-I-F. My brain says GIF, and I think that's wrong. Yeah. Okay, I just stole a bunch of GIFs from the internet for this. So let's think of, we're talking about jet streams, and we're talking about waves, and it's all kind of esoteric. Let's talk about just going to, you know, Oxford Mall or whatever, and let's talk about whether or not the shoppers and the commuters are impatient, whether they're sitting riding the escalator. The escalator is going to be our jet, and the people moving down the escalator, down the down escalator, or up it, the down escalator, are waves. Okay, so people riding escalators, nothing more than that. All right, let's start with that exotic case, that negative Mach number, which turns out to be what all the textbooks have been covering for the last 120 years. This looks so much fun. Look at that. I have some cousins in New Hampshire, and so I have been cross-country skiing. Anybody been cross-country skiing? The little skis that have the bow, and you have to kind of put your weight on it to get it to stick. That's what this guy's got. Okay, so why is that a negative Mach number? So the jet is the escalator. All three of my examples are down escalators, okay? So the jet is going down. Basically, if the escalator is winning, what I mean by that is if the person riding the escalator is going altitude-wise in the same direction as the escalator. so going down on a down escalator, then it's going to be supersonic. But this is the exotic supersonic. The person is not even going upstream, which is what we would normally think about when we think about Mach numbers is upstream. They're actually going downstream. And so if you're going in the same direction, remember the minus U over C. Both the U and the C have the same sign, the minus sign. So this is the negative Mach number case. It's just this guy. Okay. Supersonic. The escalator is going to win, but the people or the waves are going upstream. Okay? This one felt hilarious. Look at this poor lady. But guys, look at this lady. Oh my gosh, I'm okay. Damn. I can't think of it. Darn. Okay, is it sick that I could sit here and watch this for hours? This is a short loop, but it's so funny. You've got this gentleman trying to help. This lady makes it almost, and then she goes. And then this guy's almost making it, but he's too tired. And then she falls in front of him, and then he's got to, he has to give up because she's coming after him right there. And he's like, oh, even though he can't go around. I'm sorry. Anyway, that's supersonic. So the that's what an aerodynamic engineer would normally call supersonic. So he's got a jet or a flow that's going faster than the waves. The waves are people trying to go upstream. Okay. So both of these, the people that are interacting with the jet or the waves interacting with the jet are going in the direction the jet's trying to go. Right. So those are the two kinds of supersonic. I call this paranoid supersonic because if your idea is to have the information not come upstream, you don't even have to worry about it because the skier is going downstream. You don't care about, he's not carrying any information upstream, he's helping you. And downstream, these poor people are really trying, really, really trying. Okay, so enough of that. So that's both kinds of supersonic, and they're both covered by the reciprocal Mach number being less than one. Okay, so what's subsonic look like? Let's draw a line here and go over to the right, which is subsonic. Subsonic is Mach number less than 1, like you'd expect, but also bigger than 0, because if you're negative, you're going to be this guy. Okay, so subsonic is Mr. Joe Fitness up there early in the mall when everyone else is walking around the mall and he's going up the down escalator and he's making progress. So he actually makes it. So that's your standard wave that is fast enough to go upstream and not be blown downstream. So the information, whatever he's carrying, whatever information he is, the wave is carrying, is going to make it eventually. So that's your typical subsonic case. The down escalator is losing. Down escalator is winning, the down escalator is losing. Those are the cases. We wouldn't have even considered this for sound waves or buoyancy waves because they go in both directions and we always have essentially this case or this case. We don't even have that case. Okay. The subsonic case, you can write it as if the Mach number is less than 1, that means the reciprocal is bigger than 1. So this is really neat. This is how we think about these things now. This inverse reciprocal Mach number is less than 1, covers both those cases. That's the supersonic case. That turns out to be stable for shears. And then the subsonic case is unstable. All right, one last little thing, and then we're on to our application. This is just a number line for the Mach number. And so the Kelvin-Arnold curve stability, that thing that goes from 1880 all the way to 1940, 1960, that one is the negative Mach number part, so 0 and 1. Then you have the regular, like an aeronautic engineer would say, a supersonic case. That one's stable. That's the one that you don't find in the textbooks, which turns out to be more important. And then if you take the reciprocal Mach number line, then negative numbers are still negative numbers. And then so going from 1 to infinity, it maps to 0 to 1. So a really large number maps to a really small number. So it flips and goes like that. So in other words, they concatenate. So that's that point that you get this. Now, that's the math, and everything green there has been proven rigorously by all these gentlemen going on since the 1880s. Okay? But we have been stuck there. In fact, science historians have actually called this out and started to complain that there just has not been, in this particular branch of fluid mechanics, there's just not, it's clearly not as much progress as there should be. You know, they think in terms of decades, too. They look at all the different results that everybody's getting, and they say, shear stability is not moving. And the reason I think is because we didn't have, it would be like doing aeronautics without a Mach number or hydraulics without a crew number. We didn't have this, the Mach number of analog for the vorticity wave. Okay, so the thing that's important physically, if you think physically, is like I said, if you go from supersonic to subsonic, you have to go through a shock. So here my applied mathematician colleagues say, all we know, Tim, is the green here, that's stable. We don't know what happens over here. We have no math theorem over here. And I'm countering that by saying, physically, you have to have a shock right there. You're going out of your stable interval, out of your theorems, through a shock. That's your instability. It's right there. And there's been no, that's been out since like 2014, so it's going on 6 years now. There's no counterexamples that are known. And we do have a lot of, quite a lot of verification of this. This is a model with two layers with sinusoidal jets like Jupiter has. This is the instability growth rate. You can see the instability versus Mach number starts right at the sonic condition, right when you go from supersonic to subsonic, it picks up right there. So there's all kinds of numerical, but no math proof. I have a feeling once someone finds it, they're going to go smack like that. But anyway, that's where we're at. So there's a shock right there. That's the application. Now, we have a candidate, a conjecture, for this shear instability, or where it starts, what I would call the on-off switch. Even if it hasn't been proved mathematically yet, it's a very viable candidate. I really do not think it's going to be overturned. And someday it'll be proven. We can, with that in hand, it's almost engineering at this point. We can do all kinds of applications. So let me end now with just four brief looks at these applications. And some of these I've been mentioning over the last couple of years here, so I won't take like a slide for each one. Okay, so the first one is deep jets on Jupiter. This is the idea that these alternating jet streams back and forth are right at marginal stability, which would mean, remember, supersonic is stable, so subsonic is unstable. So you're, if you're unstable, you're going to slide to right to marginal. So that's sonic. And so if you take the black line, that's true. That is the Cassini spacecraft measuring the clouds and making a jet stream profile. See the beautiful dozens of jets on Jupiter. So black is just cloud top jets that we have on Jupiter. The red is the jet that you have deep in the atmosphere if your Mach number is 1. Okay? And so that was actually found back in 1989 from this range from minus 40 to minus 10, right here. So this one and this one. Basically the great red spot and a white oval. We had enough vorticity data back in the 80s and Voyager data to actually figure out this red line underneath here. And I actually talked, that was, I don't know how many people came to the talk from last year, but remember my title was What's Under the Great Red Spot. That was the whole, that's what that's all about. So we were able to, back in 1989, we knew there were deep jets, and we knew what they looked like. In fact, we actually published what we thought they looked like, this whole red line from North Pole to South Pole, before the Galileo probe went in. And it's in 1995 here, right at about 7 degrees north latitude. It's not marked on here, but it's right where that horn is. We actually put a probe, our one and only probe, into Jupiter, and in fact found that the winds went from about 100 meters per second, which is 200 miles an hour, to about 170 meters per second, which is exactly what was predicted. So we have known that there are deep jets on Jupiter from this reason and other reasons a long time. So this was now Juno, and I did make this point last time. This is the confirmation. Jupiter's atmospheric jet streams extend thousands of kilometers deep. That was just 2 years ago. So that's one of the four, is that we predicted the deep jets and we know what they look like. There's some wiggle room in the stuff, in the theory and things like that, but we were expecting deep jets and we were confirmed on that by Juno. We're the only group that said the winds would be deep and strong. So that was a good Louisville, 4-1 for Louisville. All right, number two out of the four, Saturn. Saturn's rotation period. The first try was by Herschel. No Herschel? You guys, the astronomers know Herschel. Very prolific. He and his sister. His sister, he used to polish his mirrors like this, and his sister would see him. So he didn't have to stop polishing his mirrors. He had bigger, better telescopes than the British government did, than any national observatory in the world did. Herschel in his backyard had the bigger, and it was just incredible. So he was the first one to try to figure out the rotation period of Saturn. That was in 1794. Decades, centuries, we're talking centuries here. So he got pretty close to what is called modern System 1, which is the equatorial jet, which is a super-rotating jet. But it's not that fundamental rotation, that bulk rotation period is what we really want. Okay, we know it's 10 hours and 30-something. And here's the playing field, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38. The official IAU official value is 10 hours, 39 minutes, 0.4. And one thing we know about that value is it is not the rotation rate of Saturn. We know for sure. It's based on what's called Saturn kilometric radiation, SKR. And Voyager 1 saw this value, and Voyager 2 saw this value, and said, we got it. Even though Saturn's magnetic field is not tilted, and when I say not tilted, 0.007 is the current upper limit degrees on the tilt of the rotation axis versus the magnetic field dipole axis. You can't measure the rotation period. It's like a lighthouse with a beam pointing straight up. It's turning, but you can't see it. So we don't have any idea what the day is on Saturn, which is really embarrassing. But we know it's somewhere like this, and it's definitely not this value because the value that they calculated went up to, Cassini had to go up to 10 hours 45 minutes and down to 10 hours 34 minutes and just flushing all over. But worse than that, the North Hemisphere and the South Hemisphere have different values. This is nothing, it's like a clutch, it's like a slipping clutch from my old Mazda that died under me when I was a grad student. Nobody drives those anymore, right? Anybody got a bad clutch?
It's a good clutch.
It's a good clutch, okay. If you have a bad clutch, it flips like crazy. So that's basically what we're measuring with this SKR is just the magnetospheric period. It's tied to the planet, but it's slipping badly by about 5 minutes, it turns out. Okay, so how do we get it? Well, it turns out that Saturn's interior, and I'm talking deep in here, has large mass anomalies that Cassini has discovered and that we have inferred by multiple ways. And these that are perturbing nearby wave-bearing fluid regions in a conspicuous manner, and that's the key. If they have something conspicuous, as you can see, it might be slightly indirect, but at least you can see it. Okay, where are those? Well, right there in the atmosphere, and right there in the inner C-ring, A, B, C. That's the C-ring, that's the inner C-ring. It turns out the ice particles that are floating in the rings are the most sensitive seismograph in the universe, in the world. They are incredibly sensitive. So if you have any mass anomalies in the planet, that over the eons and like that, you get these gorgeous little waves. They're bending waves and they're density waves. The density waves are just like spiral lines in a galaxy, the same thing. So rings support both bending waves, they're gorgeous, they look like phonographs, and then spiral bending. So there's actually a whole collection of over 60 of these waves that have been discovered. There's thousands of waves, but in the inner C ring, 60 or so that can be proven that they're not caused by any moonlit or external satellite of any type. They have to be caused, because of the direction they're going, they have to be caused by mass anomalies inside the planet. So there you go, there's the planet being conspicuous, trying to tell us its speed. Okay, so the first thing we had was the atmospheric waves. This is back in 2009, that's a group, that's us here in Louisville, figuring out, looking for the rotation period where the Mach number of these waves would be exactly one. So we basically just turn the planet to the speed where the jets would have that sonic value. It was as simple as that. It's ridiculously easy. So we did that, and we got a value of 10 hours, 34 minutes, 13 seconds, plus or minus 20. On the chart, that's what that looks like. And the plus or minus 20 is the one sigma uncertainty. And then 10 years later, just last January 2019, they finally came out with this. Look at that word, chronoseismology. I think chrono's the Greek version of the Saturn is the Roman version. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Saturn is Roman.
Sometimes the Roman god is meaner and uglier and nastier than the Greek god, and sometimes the other way around. Kronos was pretty nasty. But anyway, when you're talking about Saturn and you want to be Greek or fancy, you say Kronos something. So, chronoseismology. I mentioned that the ring particles in these, this is a schematic, but the ring particles, those waves, are incredibly sensitive. More sensitive than any seismograph we have on Earth. Unbelievable. It's really exciting, actually. And so we had the chronoseismology. First result finally came out just this last January, just exactly a year ago. And they got 10 hours 33.6. Remember, the official value is off the chart here. It's, let's see, where would it be? Right? About there. 10 hours 33.6. They have a huge error bar, about 1.9 plus and about minus 1.3. It's a little asymmetric. So that's their value here. Now, if you read the paper, 10 pages in, it says, oh, by the way, we didn't converge our model. And if you go ahead and converge the model, you have to add another minute. So really, they're right about there. Just inside there is the value. And this is the first time in the history since 1794 that we've had two independent observations of Saturn's rotation period statistically matched. So we've had 30 papers over those two centuries on this topic, and they're just buckshot all over the place. And you know, the Voyager ones were way off the chart here. And so this is the first time you've ever seen two from two totally different methods, two totally different groups come in and actually ours is inside of there. So this is, I think we're converging. All right, I'm biased, but I think we're converging. So I would put in a 4. 10 hours, 34 minutes, and plus or minus 3/10 of a second. So stay tuned on that one. Of course, I'm feverishly trying to get the next papers and try to refine the model. Everything I've heard and everything I've said, it's in this range right here, right in that 34 range. So that's number two. I got two more. This is the ocean, the Southern Ocean. That's, again, Drake Passage. This is the South America here. And the color map here is that, you know how I kind of was favoring the reciprocal Mach number? Because it sort of was, if you're less than it, then you're supersonic, and if you're greater than it, then you're subsonic. It's kind of that dividing point. Well, that's what this plot is here. You can't see the numbers here, but this white here is one. That's that sonic case here. These are this is zero. Blue is zero. So these are the negative ones. This is that Arnold one, that original sort of embarrassing negative Mach number range. And this is the supersonic range from blue to white. And then anything that's red is going to be that subsonic or unstable case. And so you see, this is a snapshot. This is from the Southern Ocean State Estimate, a SUSE model that's put together with five-day averages over the period from 2005 to 2010. That's actually 6 years. That's 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So 6 years. It's a very valuable data set, full three-dimensional from the ocean bottom all the way to the surface. And so we've been looking at that. And darned if the ACC lights up white here. And then there's this beautiful lane of blue. Now blue is mixed, sort of a mixed region. When I was at MIT, trying to get tenure, everybody on the faculty thought that this plot, had it been made back then, would be entirely blue. That the ocean was mixed. That was, there's hundreds of papers on that. Mixed, mixed, mixed. In fact, David Marshall, the colleague we have at Oxford, his PhD, he was a grad student while I was there, and his PhD is the Southern Ocean assuming mixed vorticity, so it would be entirely blue. Well, it turns out they were right a little bit. There's this little lane right here. But this is just like Jupiter. So that's a snapshot, and then we were interested, let's go ahead and average this over the whole six-year period, and it cleans up really nice. You still get that little mixed lane right there, but this is the jet trying to thread its way through here, and these are for all the more just like whitewater rafting. This is like little hydraulic jumps here. This is white, remember, that's that sonic. So that here the flow, that gentleman that was going up just as fast as this, you know, not quite losing ground, not quite gaining ground. So these are the Rossi waves here, and these white patches here are going westward at just exactly the rate at which the Antarctic circumpolar current is going this way. So now Jupiter is white all over. It's just, and Saturn is that guy too, very nearly white all over. But the ocean is showing it at these regions here. Nobody thought, what the heck are those? Well, my colleagues knew right away. I didn't, because I'm not an oceanographer. So if you look at the bathymetry, this is the deep, this is the Southern Ocean floor here. Like at that guy right there. There's this huge mid-ocean crack here, mid-ocean ridge. It's setting off this one. Perfect alignment there. This one is this one. This is a little plate that's in South America, one of the smallest plates in our crust, and it's sort of doing a little subduction right here, right off of South America. And that little trench right there is causing this. And this mess right here is involved here. It's not one-to-one, but it's darn close. This whole mess here is that. So we've got the Rossi waves are basically being attaching themselves to the bottom topography. You might say, oh, of course they are, but like, this is new. This is still under review. When it hasn't even come out yet. So the first paper is basically the one that's being reviewed right now is this stuff. And then we've just got started on this. We're really excited about the correlation between the stationary or the sonic Rossi wave stuff here. And you can see this Mach number, or this reciprocal Mach number, is really revolutionizing how we think about these jet streams. That's the point. Okay, last point, last one, number four, is the challenge and promise of studying burning plasmas. This is actually from last month's Physics Today. Did anybody get Physics Today and leap through it yet? Probably haven't leaped through it. Yeah, this article is in December's Physics Today, written by the associate director at the Princeton Fusion Lab and the director of this thing, which is the International Fusion Research Facility, ITER, which is being built in France in... It looks like Provence. Is it Provence?
Provence.
Yeah, so in Provence, France. And it's not going to even be ready. You can see that's the picture from like this year. It's only like half built. It's billions of dollars. Billions. Tens. Oh my God. You know how much money we've spent on it. We don't have a single volt of fusion electricity come from it yet. But they've, all these countries, US, the Europe, all these tokamaks are trying to get, because if we could get it to work, it would just solve all kinds of problems. Right, because you just have to have deuterium and tritium, and those are not that exotic, they're not that hard, we have a lot of that, and we would get endless energy supply. So they're really trying, but they haven't actually got it to work yet. This is the one that everyone, and they're all biased, of course, this is the one that everyone thinks is going to work, because it's big enough. All right, so this is very ambitious. And so to finish off this talk and kind of tie in our Jupiter and Saturn and ocean stuff over really big crossing of disciplines over to the plasma fusion, I want to just give you a sense of how incredibly tight it is mathematically. In geophysical fluid dynamics, that was like Jupiter, Saturn, and the ocean, the 1, 2, 3 examples I showed you. We have an incredible connection mathematically, even at the nonlinear level, between that and magnetized plasma. So you wonder, and that'll be my number four here. In what is called geophysical fluid dynamics, which encompasses all of the stuff that I'm doing here, that's called the Charney-Obukhov equation, and it's simply conservation of vorticity. That's all it is. And the unknown is the stream function. So I didn't show you the equation, but I showed you parts of it. It's basically they've got the Coriolis acceleration now. What does the Coriolis acceleration do? It makes things go in circles. Highs go this way and lows go this way, and it's making your vortices. That's what the Coriolis force does. It always turns you to the right. There's a stream function. That's our unknown. Remember, if I take the derivative of that, you get the velocity. And there's this deformation length, LD, that you saw in a couple of these equations. If you go over to the magnetic plasma, this is big tubes or these tokamaks, great big bagels. They have a very strong magnetic field. They have an incredibly hot plasma, and they confine it by magnetic fields. Well, the magnetic field, guess what the magnetic field does? Right? Charges go in circles in magnetic fields. It's exactly mathematically exactly the same as the Coriolis effect. And so there's a one-to-one correspondence. It's an analogy. It's not that there's a Coriolis effect, there's a magnetic effect, but it's mathematically it's the same. When we have a stream function, they have the electric potential. Exactly the same. The equation's the same. When we have the deformation length, they have the Larmor radius. Everything's there. They have vortices, they have jet streams, they have discoveries, rediscoveries. We discover what they discover what we discover. One of the ones I would point out that they discovered first that wasn't discovered, when Juno went over the pole and saw those crystal-like vortices that were really stable, they weren't gobbling each other, then somebody nudged somebody else and said, if you look at the plasma literature, about 30 years ago, they had vortex crystals. They had it first. So it's been sloshing back and forth between they'll make a discovery and it comes over to the geophysical fluid, or the GFC makes a discovery. So that's over 100 years of sloshing back and forth. Because the mathematical analogy is perfect. It's incredible. In fact, this equation works better for this case than it does for meteorology. Okay, there's been lots of papers, and I'm almost done here. Lots of papers. This is going back to Pat Diamond, 2005, zonal flows and plasma. So zonal flows, that's what I do for Jupiter, Saturn, but they're also very important for, they're not what keeps the plasma together, they aid it. And there's really the one true breakthrough with fusion electricity. It's what's called the LH transition. It's low to high confinement. Everything's about getting that really hot plasma to not break out and burn down the reactor. When I say hot, 100 million Kelvin. Hotter than the core of the sun. And you say, that's what you're trying to do, it's fusion like the core of the sun. But we don't have the pressure that the sun has. Because of that, we have to go to higher temperature by a lot, by a factor of 6, hotter than not the surface of the sun, which is just 6,000 Kelvin, but the center of the sun. Hotter than, to get this to work. It's nuts, right? But all these countries, all this money. And so we're trying to get it to work. To get that hot thing, it can't touch anything. That's why they use a torus. Because then a torus doesn't have ends. It's like a tube with no ends, right? And then they just have to confine it this way. But they haven't. They've been really struggling for decades now. And tens of billions of dollars. Anyway, so it turns out that when they make this wonderful thing, they finally had this LH transition, this low to high confinement, where it's actually going from not working to working, zonal jets appear. And so zonal jets, which I'll show you a picture of what they look like, and it'll have a bun cake in it, which might affect whether or not you get some dessert in a minute. Zonal jets show up and save the day. So they don't actually do most of the confinement, but they make the confinement go from low to high, from not working to working. So zonal jets are implicated, and these are just some of the papers here. This is zonal flows in magnetically confined plasma experiments. The Strata, this came out just last year. And then there's another one in that same, there's a big zonal jets book, zonal flow in magnetically confined plasma theory. This is Paul Terry at University of Wisconsin. Okay, so it's all the same. Even to the point, it's hard to read the words here. I just took a screenshot from a page. This is the Max Planck Institute of Plasma Physics in Germany. Very big deal. And this is a gentleman whose name is, hard to read on here, Kyle Obrez. Carl Halachek, one of the numerical modelers at the Max Planck Institute for Fusion Research. He, on the same page, has Jupiter simulations and his tokamak simulations. And so that is a big deal now, trying to understand the zonal jets in both cases. And we've figured out Jupiter, basically. So what we've been trying to do is through that information, boy, take something as big as plasma, people, and try to tell them you've got something, and just to get them to answer your email. But they are finally, so we'll see how that goes. All right, well, this is a schematic of what these things look like. This is my last slide here. So if you take a cutaway of these tokamaks, the zonal jets are actually moving in this direction, like this. So we call this the small radius here, and this is fancy name for this is the Pelotto direction. So zonal jets and tokamaks, accelerator is a tokamak. By the way, tokamak is just the Russian acronym for toroidal chamber with magnetic confinement. Tokamak. It's just pronouncing a Russian acronym. That's all that word is. It just means one of these bagels that has a magnetic field holding it in. If you twist it, it works a little better, and that's called accelerator. It's kind of the same idea with a little bit of a twist. As you can see, this is actually accelerator here. Anyway, they circulate, the zonal jets circulate in what's called the poloidal direction, and I can never remember which one's toroidal and which one's poloidal, except I always think in terms of food. So, if you remember the bundt cake ridges direction, you're good. Okay, poloidal, the direction of the zonal jets on the accelerator or a tokamak is in the bundt cake, there's the bundt cake ridge there. Look at that cream filling. I mean, come on. Do they have that downstairs?
No.
I'm getting hungry. So anyway, this is so the other direction, so I would call it the frisbee groove direction. That's the toroidal one. No, I'm not talking about it. I'm talking about the poloidal. So these zonal jets are actually going around like this. So it's kind of like the North Pole going around like that. And those, when those are not there, they are losing. All those billions of dollars is not working. So as soon as those zonal jets start alternating and show up, just like you see on Jupiter and Saturn, they win. It's because they suddenly have jets holding a red spot and white ovals in place. Exactly analogously the same thing. They need this anomaly, which is this high density, very, very, very hot plasma. It's the great red spot between two jets. These are exactly the same mathematically, exactly the same thing. So this is really exciting. All right, last thing here. Hot plasma confinement, cool plasma confinement. My last slide. On the left is the really hard thing, but the one that we want to work, which is to get the plasma to work. But when I say hot, it's literally, let's count them. Oh my gosh. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 zeros. That's 10 to the 8th is the minimum temperature at which you can get fusion to happen in one of these things. That's so hot. There's, I mean, you only have to go to about here to have nothing. I don't care if it's zirconium, molybdenum, platinum. I don't care what alloy you make. Nothing can hold that. Nothing can hold that. It's hotter. This is 10 times, about 6 times hotter than the inside of the sun. So it's just like, why are we even doing this? It's ridiculous. Well, that's what they've been trying to do. And to solve one of the problems, which is basically to have your tube not have its ends melt, is to not have any ends. That's why they wrap it around into a torus. So that's the preferred topology, is a torus to avoid melting the end of the tube by eliminating the ends. Then you just have to have this direction to try to combine something. There's a conundrum, though. Jupiter and all of our Jupiter is really the king of alternating jets, which remember are needed to get this confinement to be high confinement to work. Jupiter works by one way. I call it the Jupiter style way. It works by what's called boundary control, which is up and down, like high, low, of the deep jets. They cause the bottom boundary condition for the troposphere to be up and down, up and down. That is critical. If you flatten that out and take away the deep jets, your model will turn into pink soup. It'll shatter. Those jets are so strong. Remember, they're violating all of the stability theorems and all of the textbook by a factor two. They have to have that support of those deep jets, which causes that high and low, high and low. We call that boundary control of stretching vorticity. That's the fancy name. That's what Jupiter style is. That's the way you do jets. And if you want to engineer your jet to do anything, any jet can be made stable by that method. And any jet can be made unstable by that method because we have the on-off switch, which we haven't had for the 200 years we've been looking for. We have it. And so we can make, you want to ignite your fusion, and you want a zonal wind to do that. You want to extract energy, and you want a different zonal wind to do that. You want to get the ash out. There's actually a helium ash that you have to pull out of these things. You have a different zonal wind profile that would optimize that. We can stabilize or destabilize any one of those exactly. It's down to engineering now. That's what we can do. But we can only do it if we can make these ridges on the edges. It has to be boundary control. I can't have one of these things with no end to it. I have to be on the two ends making my little highs and lows. So it's a real conundrum right now. If you have to have the torus, you're in trouble. So the fancy way of saying that is, so in mythology, Jupiter / Zeus disguised himself as a bull / torus. Yet when it comes to zonal jet stability, I would say Jupiter's not bullish on the torus. Okay, last slide here is the much easier case, which is cooled plasma. Now, that's not nearly as important as fusion electricity, but it's still important. For example, if you are doing experiments with antimatter, like positrons, and you need to hold them, like for 24 hours, to inject into somebody's experiment at either Fermilab or CERN or one of these big high-energy colliders, that's a little cottage industry all its own called antimatter confinement. And so this is actually a review article that came out from Danielson et al. From UCSC, San Diego, just a couple of years ago. And it's A, B, C, D, E, F. It's six different tubes. These are called penning traps. And they're just tubes, literally, with ends on them. And the red thing is the positrons or the antimatter, and they're confining it in all these different ways. And if you go back to 1999, it was actually realized that it's exactly identical to a geophysical fluid system. In other words, if your tube has little bumps on it at the end, and your plasma goes over that and gets stretched, it pulls in and goes faster. It's exactly the same thing as in the ocean or the atmosphere or all of these. It's the stretching vortices, exactly the same thing like that. And so if you could model this, we have the formula for what the shape of this has to be to stabilize that. If you want a different jet profile, then it's a different set of highs and lows. We actually have that formula. We just read it out like an engineer. And so if I could get to the end, like here and here, we can do anything. And that's actually going to affect these guys. So that just brings it up to the present now. This is where we're at right now. And we're working with a postdoc named Noah Hurst. He's at University of Wisconsin. He came from the UC San Diego group, from Danielson's group. Now working with Paul Terry's group. Those are two people whose names just flashed by on these slides. And we're working on Jupiter-style boundary control of the zonal jets and cool plasma. So we'll do that first over the next couple of years, and then try to figure out what the heck to do with the toruses, because if the tokamak, if the fusion electricity has to be a torus, they can't do it the way Jupiter does it. And I'm just worried that means they can't do it. But for the meantime, maybe they could do it. I don't know. Hopefully they can. But they can't do it like Jupiter. But we can do antimatter and all the cool tube plasmas. We can do all that confinement, and we can design it to be just like Jupiter. We can have a red spot here, a white oval here, a cyclone here, and a cyclone there. Confine it. Jupiter is over 300. The red spot is over 300 years old. That's probably a lower limit. We know how to make that. We have models where it appears, it stays for 100 years. We've got it. So if we can get down to the end and do that boundary control, we can stabilize any jet system. So that's really exciting. And it will apply to the cool plasma case, so that's good. And the last thing is that this most of what's in this talk today is in a paper submitted. American Astronomical Society just came out with a new journal last month, the Planetary Science Journal. It's an open access journal. And so I submitted this paper on the first week of the journal. So I have a fighting chance to be in Volume 1, Issue 1, Article 1.
Wow.
I'll be in the first issue. I don't know if it's going to be the first article or not. But anyway, that's what I'm trying for. Okay, so I'm up to date. I've run out. I'm totally sulfur pewing out of here at this point. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Tim. There are any questions?
I've been amazed how weather prediction of the jet stream in the northern hemisphere is as accurate as it is weeks and weeks out. How do they do that? They can't predict weather, the surface weather, that far out, but they can predict the perturbations of the jet stream way ahead.
There's actually a quantitative measure of that called a skill level, where they take the 500 millibar and they can actually quantify that, and it has in fact gotten better. Over the years, over the last 30 years, it's gotten better. And the reason is it's because it's not affected too much by moisture. The more local scale, the mesoscale, is very tricky because it's very sensitive to how much water vapor is coming in, these little rivers of water vapor that come in. If you have a large scale, it's called planetary scale, like jet streams, they aren't really strongly affected by the water vapor content. That takes the whole variable out of the system. And the models are fast enough and strong enough now that they're doing pretty well. Like you said, they're doing pretty well for the jet streams. But eventually, they erode. Their accuracy also erodes because eventually the stuff that's coming up from the troposphere, the waves coming up from the troposphere, which are strongly affected by the moisture. So the short answer is that you don't really have moisture affecting the planetary scale. And so they're going to be the first ones to get good first. And then what's really hard is the tropics, because it's all moisture driven. And so there's a thing, there's a wave we don't even understand called the Madden-Julian Oscillation, MJO. It's about a 44-day wave that goes around the equator. And the models don't even do it. I mean, that's really embarrassing. So, but it's a moisture-driven thing. So those are really hard. So basically my answer is that if it's a moisture-driven process, has to do with latent heat and the actual amount of water vapor you have, that's twice as hard as if you're just doing a dry, big...
so it's jet dry, the jet stream is dry?
For the most part, yep, up in the stratosphere, yep. It's kind of a cold trap because it gets cold, cold, cold. The temperature gets really cold and then the stratosphere gets warm again. It's really hard to get cloud stuff to go through that. It's called a cold trap. So you end up with a really dry stratosphere. And so the jets are strongest up there. So that's the short answer is basically it's basically not nearly as many things to keep track of. You don't have to know the water vapor amount. But the prediction horizon for the planet Earth is only in a couple weeks. You know, if you have the full system.
That's pretty hopeless.
It contrasts that with the giant planets. We can predict the weather accurately to the same level on the giant planets months in advance. So we don't really have a lot of moisture to worry about. We have no mountains. And it's bigger, like much bigger. So the surface area of Jupiter is 120 times more than the surface area of Earth. So I like to think of it as ballerinas, you know, on a big, you know, the word bolshoi means large, right? It's Russian for large. So if Les and I are dancing the ballet, that would be really funny. Wouldn't charge any money for that. Anyway, if we're swinging around and we're on a big bolshoi stage, big large stage like Jupiter, we're not going to hit each other. We're just pirouette into the vortices. But now cram these same ballerinas into a large elevator, which is Earth, you know, less than 1% of the surface area, and do the same dance because the deformation length, that LD, is the same on Jupiter and Earth. It's about 2,000 kilometers. But Earth is only 6,000 kilometers radius, my God. I mean, Jupiter is 70,000 kilometers. Huge. So there's all kinds of room. So take the ballerinas and put them in an elevator, and you've got Les hitting me in the teeth, and I'm hitting you in the nose.
Is that 70,000 for the planet or the
radius
atmosphere?
Of the planet,
the whole,
Jupiter,
including the atmosphere?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell where the atmosphere is, so we say one bar, like this pressure in this room. At that level, from the center of the planet out to one bar is 70,000 kilometers, where we're about 6,700 or so. So a little bit more than 10 times bigger radius, but then you have to square it for surface area and cube it for volume, so more than 1,000 times the volume. So we can predict the weather on Jupiter better than on the Earth. But the ocean is a funny mix. It's almost like a triangle, because the ocean is giant. Its deformation length is 15 kilometers, not 2,000. Tiny little thing. And you end up, all the eddies, they look like gummy worms when you make a colored plot of them. It's incredible. The ocean is full of all these eddies. And, you know, 15 kilometers, I have to go farther than that to get home. And whereas that length scale, that deformation length on Jupiter and the atmosphere, like Jupiter and Earth, is 2,000 kilometers. So it's like, you know, from here to, I don't know, my sister in Denver. It's a lot further. So, you have a sense that the ocean, like the Southern Ocean or the basins, Atlantic, Pacific, they are giant. They are huge if you measure them relative to the eddy size. That's a good way to think about it. So they're giant, but they're not gas. They're horrible boundary conditions. You know, I had to go to all kinds of trouble just to get a jet that goes all the way around like Jupiter does. There's only one that does. You got these basins, and you try to go east and west, and you hit that, and you hit that. So it's a giant, but it's not a gas giant. So it's like a triangle. There's Earth's atmosphere that's tiny and cramped, and you have all this jostling, which is part of the unpredictability. And you have mountain ranges. It's just the worst boundary condition and the worst cramped conditions. We have the most unpredictable weather in the solar system, our planet. I don't know if that's required for life or not, but we have it. And then you have this giant, but not gas giant. You have the gas giant, like we've been talking about, and then you have the ocean, which is giant, but horrible boundary conditions. So it's really a triangle. So in other words, another way to put that is that Jupiter is just as analogous to Earth's atmosphere as it is to Earth's oceans. Jupiter has ocean-like properties, and it has atmospheric-like properties. So we get all three, and that's great to be able to study these things and have all those different examples. That's really, really helpful to compare them.